I'm very happy to introduce Dr. Robin Tamlin, who's a professor in the department and who is also the scientific director of the CIHR Institute for Health Services and Policy Research. And Robin has put together this very exciting session on health services. So Robin, up to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, and I want to introduce my two colleagues, Dr. Michael Scholl, who's a graduate from our department, actually, and Michael's a professor at the University of Toronto now in the Department of Medicine, and he's also just taken on not that long ago as president and CEO of the Institute for Clinical and Evaluative Sciences at ISIS, or ISIS as it's called. He's also an emergency room physician and been a past Harkness Fellow and does many other achievements. And it's very exciting because I think he's turned the ship of ISIS in a whole different direction. And the other very important colleague to me is Dr. Jean-Louis Denis. And Jean-Louis actually was the chair of my institute advisory board for quite some time. Very humorous, just a wonderful chair, and led us down a very important pathway for the institute. He's a professor at the École nationale d'administration publique, where he is a CRC chair in... I'm just trying to remember, Jean-Louis, here. It's in governance and transformation in governance of the healthcare system. So really very timely. He's also a member of the Royal Society of Canada. So an illustrious panel for sure. And so I just want to set the tone of the day for where I think we may be going when it comes to health services and policy research. And I think it's probably driven by something that's already been raised earlier in the previous panel, which is that healthcare spending has spiraled upwards in a systematic way without showing any sign of leveling off. Canada is just a group in there showing a similar kind of increase in spending. We're now spending $230 billion a year on healthcare in Canada. And I think the difficulty with this is, are you getting good value for your money? And in fact, comparing ourselves to other socialized healthcare systems, the answer is, if it weren't for the United States, that we would be at the bottom of the barrel in terms of that. So we are grateful to people from the South who are here, because otherwise we would not be looking particularly good. And it's because I think we didn't do things that others did do in trying to re-steer the healthcare system to deal with the challenges of chronic disease prevention and management. And had we done that, such as what had been done in the United Kingdom in the early days of the NHS, when it also was at the bottom of the leaderboard in terms of quality, is they really dug in and really transformed the health system. And I think Jean-Louis may speak to this. And in doing so, if we had done that, in fact, we would have saved almost $660 billion in healthcare in Canada. And so it really is what are we spending on healthcare, but what are we losing as a result of failing to transform the system in Canada? And in fact, I just want to translate that dollar amount into something that may be meaningful to you, because it has to do with other social and environmental programs. So if we had done what the NHS did, we could have actually had, you know, we could have had $5 daycare for almost 15 million children. We could have also put almost 23 million people through university free of charge. And that would matters a lot in Quebec, actually, that we could send people free of charge through university, meaning we're sacrificing education. Or alternately, we could have built almost 9,000 or more Trans-Canada highways. So there's something that we're losing by failing to act. And so I think that when we look forward at, well, what do we need to do, there are canaries in the coal mine, and people say you shouldn't look at the high-cost spenders, but it is something that really does matter, because if you don't deal with this, you really can't free up money to deal with the other things that you should be doing in terms of social determinants of health. And so we have this phenomenon, the long tail and the distribution, where 5% spend over 50% on healthcare costs. There always has to be someone at the top of the distribution, but when you're persistently up there, and really the question has to be asked, could you do better with those individuals? And so in looking at these individuals, in fact, the Institute of Medicine put out a report on the learning health system, and they said, look, these are the individuals that never get into any kind of clinical study or any kind of clinical trial, so we really don't know very much about them. But we actually provide service to those individuals day after day after day, and we learn nothing from that experience, and we should learn something from that experience. There's almost a trillion bits of data that are generated every day in Canada from their healthcare system, and we do not mine that information to figure out how we could be doing better, how we could predict outcomes differently, how we could intervene differently, could we the interventions that we try, which are natural experiments in groups like this because they aren't part of any real studies, is that actually we could evaluate that. And if we should build something called a learning health system which actually mines that kind of data so that we can learn on the fly, on the go, different methods, different approaches, and a different mindset, I think. And if we were going to do that, we would need some key things to happen, which my colleagues, I think, will speak to. One is that we need actually clinical policy and, believe it or not, scientific leadership. You know, it's not going to happen. If you look at any organization across the country, you say, where is a scientific leader that is actually investigating what you're doing, how well you're doing, comparing it to others? I don't think you'd find a single person who has that job right now, but I think that's the way of the future. It has to be. And number two, it has already been raised, which is that, you know, that experience, that trajectory, there's no one that knows that better than the patients themselves who have to live through that experience, and we do not mind their knowledge and their ideas about how they could do it better. So we have to get going on that. And in order for us to actually build and understand what's happening in healthcare and actually do better is that we need all the things in the bottom. We need actually data. We need analytics. And we need essentially that information to be turned into knowledge that will help us figure out how to do better. And there's this is, I think, where epidemiology, biostatistics, and other disciplines sit. This is really where their expertise is and where they can contribute in a major way. So when you look at our past is that we've used data from birth and death registries initially, then hospital discharge abstract data, from survey data. And now I think we're into a new wave, and I think this department has provided leadership here in using first population level administrative data that's coming out of a socialized system, and now we're going to move on to other things. We're going to move on to electronic medical records. We're going to move on to hybrids, registries that are linked together essentially with clinical feeder systems, and then finally real-time data monitoring and analytics. So I think this is where we're going in the future. We'll need it to actually support that health system. And in fact, I think that we have, Canadians overall have provided leadership here. So if we look at the birthplace of using administrative data for research, it started with Nora Lou Roos out in Manitoba, Eugene Veda in Toronto, and Walter Spitzer. I had a hard time finding a picture of Walter, actually. You can see he's kind of trying to duck out of sight. Perhaps because there was one of his infamous reports, but and Sammy Suisa. And this group, essentially, of people actually figured out how to use the natural opportunities that are afforded by a universal healthcare system to actually mine that data to figure out how we could understand how things were performing in the health system. And they figured out how to put all these data together to create such as this, a longitudinal history of events, of what happened to people along the way, leading the way. And in fact, one of the earliest studies, the birth of, I would say, pharmacoepidemiology, was this phenomenon in New Zealand where asthmatics started dying like flies. And it was some new drug that had come on the market, and Walter and Sammy Suisa were afforded the opportunity to look at the Saskatchewan databases to say, what is it that's going on with this drug? Identified that this drug and the potency of this drug was the thing that was responsible for an excess of asthma deaths and near asthma deaths. So it's an exciting opportunity. A similar opportunity existed when one of the members of our department, Dr. David Buckridge, actually looked at essentially the policy, and this is cross-border changes in public health policy, to actually use our data to look at policies of introducing vaccinations for influenza in 2 to 4 year olds in Boston compared to what was happening here in Montreal where that didn't happen, and showing overall in the population what kind of an impact that had, meaning a higher, lower rate essentially of influenza in Boston. So what's next? Well, I think we're just starting on this. I think we've already seen some really interesting studies coming out of electronic medical records where you get much more refined, much more granular clinical data that you really need. And one of the most interesting studies that came out of that was a study that actually challenged the untruism that MMR vaccination actually increased the risk of autism. So this was the GPRD database, 5 million people in the United Kingdom. That data was mined to actually refute essentially the false publications that were made about this association. If we look just to the south, in fact, we see that groups such as the group in Boston, who has assembled 16 hospitals under Partners Group and actually put together a data warehouse of all their data, so they could start looking and retrieving data such as this from essentially their clinical databases and could use that to conduct association type of research or identify people who would be, for example, here, similar group at Reichenstrafe in Indianapolis, Indiana. Who are essentially using their data repositories to identify people who would be eligible and appropriate for studies. So this is really exciting stuff because, in fact, it means that you're actually using live clinical data to actually conduct studies in a way you could never have conducted them before. And it also means that you can actually attach things to that that essentially will allow you to deliver both real-time analytics and real-time decision support on the basis of the information you find. And so here was an example of trying to take a kind of complex Cox proportional hazards model and try to predict on the basis of the psychotropic drugs used by a given individual what their risk was of having a fall-related injury in the next year. And in fact, you can see how complicated that would be. You're not exactly going to do this at the point of care in your office, but in fact, you can actually do this using computerized systems and you can apply epidemiology at the point of care. So I think this is really exciting, and you can show that these kinds of things do make a difference in terms of outcome, meaning that you're actually giving people real-time information on what the risk is. So I think we're just at the beginning of an era that will allow us to do this. And then finally, this issue of using the internet. The internet and social media have provided us with an imaginable opportunity to do things differently. And so here was a Montrealer by the name of John Brownstein who actually created HealthMap, where he actually used what was on the internet to essentially identify the outbreaks of flu. And it showed that for H1N1, in fact, that he could identify this almost 2 weeks earlier than the CDC Sentinel surveillance system. So very exciting times. I want to mention, finally, as a person from time to time spends their time at CIHR, that CIHR is actually investing in learning health systems. They are investing majorly through the strategy for patient-oriented research in essentially trying to learn from the healthcare system of today and change it, not in 10 years, but within the years to come. So it's over $100 million a year that's being spent there to build this kind of an entity for Canada. And finally, the road ahead for epidemiology, from my perspective, is that we really are the foundational science to make this kind of system transformation in healthcare. I do think that we will tackle, I think, very effectively the new challenges of new methods for real-time data management and monitoring and analytics. I think we have the capacity there, and I think that we could ramp up our ability if we start partnering essentially with other disciplines that I think can bring something to the table, such as computer science and bioinformatics, clinical epi, of course, and health policy and decision science. So thank you very much, and I would now want to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Jean-Louis Denis, who I think will provide us with a very interesting perspective on sort of the governance strategy that needs to be put in place for something like this. So Jean-Louis,